introduce Akashati. And I introduce Lokabandhu, who was the first speaker of the Dharmapala this year. And now I'm introducing Akashati, who is the last speaker in the Dharmapala this year. And I'm actually kind of walking in Akashati's shoes, because the Dharmapala, I organized it last year, but in the previous year it was organized by Akashati. Akashati's been involved with Buddhafield for a long, long time, and she's been very, very important in Buddhafield. And last year she's taken a step back, she's decided to explore new horizons and started a whole new life, actually. So she's had quite a period of change, quite big significant changes in the recent past. And in Buddhafield she's been particularly important, because there are not a lot of female order members around at Buddhafield. It just seems to be more male order members who want to do this kind of thing. I came here on Saturday a week ago, and on Sunday I was having some tea with Mumukshus, and we discovered there were 120 people on site, and she and I were the only women order members. And that's been the position that Akashati has been in a lot in the past. So there's been a lot of women coming through Buddhafield who've benefited tremendously just because of Akashati's capacity for friendship and her clarity about the Dharma, her patience and her big heart. So, let's start.
Okay, well, welcome everyone. Nice to see you all. My subject is about building the Buddha land, and particularly in relation to our work transforming the world and ourselves through the work we do, whatever it is. And when I use the term work, I'd like to use that in quite a kind of broad sense. I mean, it may be the actual job we do, that, you know, our livelihood and so on, or it may be just, you know, the thing in our lives that we really put energy into and that we stay with and that we engage with something in that sort of spirit, you know, that we kind of take it on. So, yes, quite a broad definition of work in that sense, you know, maybe sort of a volunteering thing or whatever. As Yasha Bodhi mentioned, I've worked for Buddhafield for 7 years. I was part of the Buddhafield team initially just in the summer, but then as it all got bigger it became a kind of year-round job. Lots of the behind-the-scenes stuff happens over the winter, so I've been doing that for 7 or 8 years. And but, you know, as happens with even the best of things, I got to a point where I felt I'd sort of got to the end of something. I don't know, one never knows quite why with these kind of things, but I sort of felt it was time to move on. And so I've done that. And I'm now in the kind of slightly strange position of having a straight job. I came from work on Friday, I'm working tomorrow morning, so flying visit to the festival, not being involved with the organisation and everything. But it's really lovely to be here, as always. And I'm now working teaching in a special school near Brighton. So I'll just sort of draw on mainly, you know, those are the things that I personally have done, but hopefully, you know, draw out things that will be significant for everyone. There's some little quotes in the talk, and they come from, I'm sure some of you will recognise, they come from something called the Shambhala Warrior Mind Training Precepts. And this is something I find just popping up into my mind over and over again. So here we go. Hold in a single vision, in the same thought, the transformation of yourself and the transformation of the world. Live your life around that edge, always keeping it in sight. as a bird flies on two wings. Balance outer activity with inner sustenance. Following your heart, realize your gifts. Cultivate them with diligence to offer knowledge and skill to the world. So, before we go on to the more bit more to the subject of work, there's this. The main title is this: Building the Buddha Land. So, I just want to say a little bit about that. So, a Buddha Land is a kind of mythic dimension, particularly in the Mahayana schools of Buddhism, sort of slightly later school, and there are poetic descriptions of Buddha lands or Buddha fields. The terms are sort of more or less interchangeable. So a Buddha land is a place of incredible beauty. There are jewel trees, and it's a very, very positive place to be. Everyone who's there is happy. Everyone is practicing the Dharma, and the birds themselves are singing teachings to those people. So, various other. Apparently, Buddha lands are the ground is perfectly smooth and flat. I never used to understand why that was such a great thing, because I always thought, oh, but I like mountains and hills. But since I've been camping and stuff, I get what they mean now. So obviously, you know, it's a mythic evocation of a situation that is a supportive context. It's the best possible context that we could possibly find ourselves in, or even place ourselves in. A Buddha land is a place where the conditions that we're in support our practice of ethics, our practice of awareness, reflection, and those kind of things. So everything there is encouraging us rather than drawing us away from those things. So, you know, possibly it's useful to think about a situation that would be almost the reverse of a Buddha land. You know, a situation where the odds are just stacked against us. You know, we might be trying to do something positive in the world. We might be trying to kind of act for the best. But, you know, it seems like everything is kind of acting against us. So that's the kind of situation that, you know, maybe one might say would draw out more of us individually, because we have more to sort of fight against. But I think it's true for most, pretty well everyone. I don't know if I've ever met anyone who doesn't agree with this. If you're trying to practice the Dharma over a period of time, you're trying to really deeply engage with this path of personal transformation, it is very, very difficult to do without the support of other people. Maybe it's not impossible. There are these characters called Pratyeka Buddhas, who are a bit of a mystery in the tradition, who do it all on their own. But in general terms, for I think most of us, actually, we do need a positive context. And my guess is that's one reason why we're all here on this particular field right now, because we're drawn to something that is going to bring out the best in us, and is going to bring out the best in other people, and that sort of, you know, that feeds and builds. So, that's a Buddha land. Yeah. I think in a sense, when I was thinking about this, perhaps the key thing here is that a Buddha land is a place where our real needs are met, our deepest needs are met. So I found myself thinking, well, that's interesting. So I wonder, what are our deepest needs? I was remembering an incident with my sister when my nephew was young, that he made some pronouncement about, I want some chocolate. And she said, oh, but now you don't really need chocolate, do you? And there was a sort of brief pause, after which he said, I need chocolate. So, wants and needs is a kind of interesting area, isn't it? Something to sort of look at, you know, what we want, what we need. Not always the same thing. So there's a famous thing which no doubt you've all come across, is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We've printed it off the internet here, a little sort of pyramid. And I find this useful. I mean, I've never particularly studied it in depth, but just as a kind of framework. So the kind of bottom rung, as it were, is the physiological needs, the sort of needs of the body. We need air to breathe, we need food to drink, food to eat, water to drink. We need sex, that's interesting, that's on this level. We need to reproduce ourselves, no doubt, and we need sleep, and so on. So that's the sort of basic level, physical needs. When we're camping out here, you know, we need to look after those things, don't we? So, you know, that's kind of basic, and it's important. You know, staying dry and all the rest of it, trying to. The next level is safety, security of the body, employment, resources, morality, so living in a reasonably sort of ethical situation around people we can trust a little bit, family, health, property, so safety, security, that's the second level. The third level is love and belonging, so friendship, intimacy, being part of something that we feel. Yeah, that sense of belonging is very important, I think, for everyone in some way. Going further up, we have esteem, self-esteem, confidence, achievement, respect of others and respect by others. And perhaps these are some of the things that maybe our work, whatever it happens to be, is going to bring out our qualities, and inevitably we work with other people, we come up against other people as well. So that seems to me to be connected with this theme. And then at the top of the pyramid you have self-actualization. So again, he's got morality, that's interesting, that seems to go sort of right, almost right through. Creativity, spontaneity, problem solving, acceptance of facts, lack of prejudice. So I would say self-actualization is, in some ways, is the province of the Dharma. It's what Buddhism is ultimately about. And, you know, taking with us all of those other things that, you know, I think this is a really good metaphor for life. And how we lead our lives because we do need to kind of, you know, take care of the basic things and so on. You know, we may not be in a position to really take on meditation practice or something like that unless we've set up a situation in which, you know, other things, there's a certain amount of stability and so on. So but ultimately self-actualization is what the Dharma is about, and so the figure of the Buddha is an embodiment of human potential. So I'm sure everyone's familiar with, you know, the qualities of the Buddha. The Buddha is kind of the best possible sort of human being we can imagine. So completely self-aware, and therefore aware of others, able to see what's going on for other people, able to be helpful because of that, and perhaps being able to see that person's real needs, what would really help this person you know, at this point. So the history of the Buddha, you know, you read in the sutras, you know, he's wandering around northern India, he's talking to people and he's responding to that particular individual. All these teachings have come from meetings and a particular, you know, sometimes they're not always applicable to other situations, so it's quite useful to go back and think, okay, who was this teaching originally addressed to? What situation were they in? Because he said different things to different people, as we all would. So the Buddha, known for being very wise, aware, kind, completely open-hearted, not sort of into his own sort of self-aggrandizement or whatever little kind of ego thing, quite just completely free of those kind of things. And, you know, one of the practices we do as Buddhists is we just think about the Buddha and try and kind of imagine what that sort of person is like, you know, and, well, and do whatever we can in our own way to embody those qualities. And obviously that's a long that's a long job, you know, it's a path that we're on. But when I was thinking about Buddhas and qualities of enlightenment, I mean, I particularly find it inspiring to think about people like, well, Milarepa and Angulimala come to mind. They were both, well, both could be termed mass murderers in their earlier lives. And so the story of Milarepa, a famous Tibetan teacher who, he and his mother were somehow swindled out of their house and their lands by some, I don't remember if they were relatives, I think it was, anyway, they ended up being kind of done out of their possessions. And Milarepa was sent off by his mother to study black magic. These sort of things went on in Tibet. And so off he went, and he was obviously a very able to pick things up very well. So he really sort of got the teaching, the black magic teaching, and he came back and zapped the house when they were all in there, and everyone in the house was killed. So he, early in his life, he did this deed, which he then had to live with and find a way of transforming that very weighty karma, as we might say. And he realized, in, you know, the sort of language the Tibetans use, that if he died without gaining enlightenment, he would go to hell. So he had to do it all in one lifetime. And it's an absolutely amazing story. If you've never read The Life of Milarepa, read it. It's a total tearjerker, and feeling a bit weepy this morning. I don't know why, it's Butterfield. So pardon me for that. Yes, he has this very compassionate but outwardly very harsh teacher who makes him build all these towers and take them down again, and he builds a tower somewhere, then Marpa's teacher comes and says, knock it down, I want it built over there. And this goes on for years, and in so doing he goes through this process where he's kind of purifying, he's transforming himself, and he has this incredible faith in this teacher, which is amazing, because it's not a kind of, he's not a nicey-nicey smiley sort of guru. And in the end he does attain liberation, and he spends the rest of his life teaching the Dharma through song, and he's known for his songs, the 100,000 songs of Milarepa, many of which are celebrations of the natural world and the mountains and the caves where he lives. So that's a different sort of story to the life of the Buddha, but that's a tale of transformation and self-actualization, of someone reaching their full potential against all the odds. Angulimala is another good story, but there probably isn't time. So, just a little bit more on this thing about a situation where our real needs are met. I'm, as I mentioned, I'm working in a school special school in Sussex, and I've met some fantastic people. So I've met some very, very impressive people. One of whom was a guy called Mike Waters, who came to do a training session, and he's been working with what we might call challenging children. So I work in a special school, quite a range, and some children who are, I think the sort of standard word is challenging. You know, not easy. They come from very, very difficult worlds, some of those kids. And so anyway, this guy, Mike Waters, he's been working with some of the children who just haven't fitted in anywhere, and there's been major kind of stresses and difficulties. And he was talking about, so he came to do this workshop with us, and it was about the what he termed the sort of 5% of kids who just, the normal strategies that you use in teaching just don't work, so forget it. You know, you've got to be more creative in a different way. I think that's why I like this particular environment, because it's a bit more, there's a bit more kind of flexibility, and it's, you know, big schools are a bit like an exam factory these days, I'm afraid, sadly. But kind of, yeah. Anyway, Mike Waters, so he was talking about, you know, some of these kids, if you are not really helping them, genuinely responding to where they're at and what they really need, you actually can't have a relationship with them at all. You can't just have a sort of superficial thing. It just, if it doesn't really work, it's not going to work at all. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. That explains a few sort of things, you know, that I'm new to this work, so I've been kind of struggling with how to relate to some of the kids I'm teaching. And he just struck me as someone who'd thought very deeply about, well, what do people really need? You know, what do these kids really need? What would really help? And obviously been kind of working with this for many years. And I was thinking, this is the activity of a bodhisattva. I mean, he's not a Buddhist. You've probably never heard of bodhisattvas, but this is actually the activity of a bodhisattva, which is the theme of this festival, is to, whatever interaction one has, to respond in a way that is helpful, is useful, is meaningful to that individual, in a way that you are actually aware of that person and you respond to them appropriately, usefully. And that is quite an amazing thing to be doing in your work, you know, in your kind of daily life, very consciously. Anyway, I must move on. He mentioned this is another possible alternative to the Maslow's hierarchy. I think this fits in somewhere in the middle. He mentioned what he called the three hungers. I don't know if this came from him or if it's a come from some educational theory or something, I don't know. They are recognition, stimulation, or the right amount of stimulation, and structure. Structure that allows some sort of progression. So I'll maybe come back to the second two if there's time, but recognition, basically this is about awareness. And this is the, I mean, if there's one central thing in Buddhism, it is awareness. It's the practice of awareness, self-awareness, sort of being able to be open to what is really going on for us. And the more we do that, the more we can then do that for other people. If we're not aware, if we're not self-aware, we're not really going to be aware of other people to any great extent. So they're just two sides of the same coin. Recognition in terms Mike Waters talking about, I just thought, yeah, that's awareness. And I think that's why I was so impressed with this guy, actually. I just thought he's just someone who's strongly practicing awareness. And he was talking about this need for recognition and how it starts when we're babies, and we initially need someone else to, in order to learn to do things for ourselves, we need someone else to do that for us. So, you know, and these things that are relevant to babies, you know, it's, there are equivalents that go throughout our lives, so, you know, I think it's relevant to everyone. So babies need, they need empathic attunement, so sort of mimicking would be an example. So if a baby, it is a loud noise and a baby's frightened by that, a normal response would be to kind of show shock on, oh, are you frightened? Or whatever. And the baby is kind of mirrored, and in that way their experience is validated. They kind of start to understand, oh, well, they don't say to themselves, I'm experiencing fear, but you see what I mean. Something begins to, it's the beginning of the ability to recognize what one is experiencing, and we get that from other people, hopefully, if we're lucky enough. And not everyone does. Babies also need, or young children, or all of us, containment of feelings. So to be allowed to experience what, you know, to be allowed to feel sad about a loss or something like that, not to be kind of talked out of it. So through having someone else allow us to feel whatever it happens to be and give that space, we can learn to do that for ourselves. If we, you know, and we've all got our own conditioning, haven't we? If we are, you know, we are conditioned into this sense that you're not allowed to experience that, then we don't. It gets shoved down. So so that's important. And then lastly, the thing about recognition as a baby, soothing. So when a baby gets upset, well, hopefully someone will come and, you know, do what needs to be done to sort of calm them down. And in that way, the child learns to do that for themselves. So we all get upset, we all get jarred, and we can learn to kind of sort ourselves out. And that's a really important skill to have. And if we don't learn that, we go around in difficult states and we don't know how to get out of them. So anyway, I found all that very interesting. I hope you did too. So that all came out of building the Buddha Land, a situation where our deepest needs, our real needs, are met. And I think this quality of awareness, perhaps, let's just sort of stay with that's what we're about, that's what the Dharma is about, is developing that more and more. And obviously you can kind of see how that goes on from, you know, through our lives. So, you know, we're trying to create a situation which is an expression of that awareness of ourselves and of each other, and that encourages that. And that is what a Buddha field is. That is what a Buddha land is, fundamentally. And so I feel very proud to be part of this thing called Buddha field, or not so much these days, but I think it's very well named, because, you know, we come to the festival, and I think hopefully for the vast majority of us, this situation does function as a true Buddha field, as a situation which brings out the best in us, which nourishes us in those ways that are, you know, on that deepest level. So, Buddha field, okay, that's the first part of the talk. We're talking about building the Buddha land through our work. So obviously I've been talking about, you know, I mentioned I've been part of working with Buddha field, and little celebration of what many, many, many people have created here over the past however long, a couple of decades or whatever. You know, we're not all in that situation, are we? We're not all working for Butterfield or something like that. We're all doing different things. And I myself have taken myself out of this situation, and there I am. I've got a straight job. I have tried to choose a context that felt positive, where people could kind of be themselves. And I, as I say, I've been very, very impressed indeed by some of the people I've been meeting and their commitment to, well, to doing the best by the kids at our school in particular. So. I feel very lucky with the work I've done personally. I feel that I've been able to find and choose. I've had the freedom to choose contexts that have been very supportive and nourishing, and have brought out, you know, brought out my strengths in all sorts of ways. Now at this point, you know, you might be thinking, well, that's all very well. You know, what if I work in a, you know, an office or a shoe shop or a bar or whatever? You know, we all work in different situations. We're not always able to make exactly the sort of choice that we might want to make. So, you know, how do we actually practice through our work if we're in a situation which perhaps isn't ideal conditions? And obviously no situation is ideal conditions. There's always kind of difficult stuff, you know, that can be a practice in itself, of course. So I was just thinking about this. Well, you know, possible sort of objections, you know, how can I contribute to building the Buddha land? I mean, the Buddha land ideally, of course, is the whole world. Is everyone. I mean, ultimately, I'm sure we would all like to see absolutely everyone have the best possible conditions. And it's painful to see that that isn't the case for many, many people. People are born into all sorts of circumstances. But, you know, again, as Buddhists, this is the Bodhisattva ideal. This is what we're about. We are transforming the world, the whole world, not just our, you know, perhaps nice little friendly Buddhist enclave, you know. So how do we go about that when we're in situations that are perhaps not so encouraging of this kind of practice of awareness, ethics? One thing that is, you know, basic dharma is that every single thing that we do has an effect. Not only every single thing that we do, everything we say has an effect. And not just everything that we say, everything we think has an effect. Scary thought. But if you think about it, you know, think about dwelling on a certain thing, dwelling on a particular, you know, one of those conversations that you go round and round. you know, when we're thinking about something, we're bringing an attitude to it, we're bringing a certain kind of mental state, and we're reinforcing whatever that happens to be. We are creating ourselves every moment in what we do, what we say, what we think. And that might be moving in a particular direction, it might be moving in a different direction. That's something that we are trying to learn to steer, you know. And there's this image of a plane on automatic pilot, which I like from meditation retreat years ago. Apparently automatic pilots, the plane doesn't go straight at the destination, it veers off continually. And the automatic pilot is the bit that goes, whoops, oh, heading off in the wrong direction, and sort of brings you back to, you know, where you're actually consciously trying to go. So, in a sense, that's the nature of Dharma practice. You know, we're bringing that awareness, we're noticing, okay, I'm getting into a train of thought here. This is meditation retreats are fantastic for this. You know, I'm reinforcing this polarization with this particular person. It's all going on in my own mind, but actually it's having an effect. So everything we do is having an effect. What we say has an effect. A little word, a little, this thing about recognition, noticing somebody, noticing how they are. You know, a colleague who comes in, they don't look quite themselves or whatever. You know, a couple of words can have a massive effect on another person. And we can't possibly see the results of what effect we have on other people, because they then go on to, you know, they're in a particular state. You know, if I kind of yell my head off at someone, well, they're going to go off in a particular state, and, you know, quite often people repeat, you know, people who've been bullied go on to bully other people and so on. So that's a kind of negative example, but everything we do has an effect. So nothing is ever lost. That's an amazing thought, but it's, you know, it's quite a responsibility actually. And something to just sort of be quite patient with, because obviously we ain't perfect, you know, and we're not enlightened yet, and we're probably not going to be for quite some time yet. So, you know, we have to bring some acceptance to this, but not lose sight of the fact that, yeah, actually we are having an effect, and it's our responsibility to work with that. So, if we're in a situation with other people, which we no doubt are in our work, we are having an effect, whether we like it or not, and we can make some difference towards what effect we are having on the people around us. And that's quite a useful thing to reflect on. You know, another possible objection might be, you know, I'm working with people who don't share my values. I'm working in a situation that isn't expressive of my values. And that's, you know, that's a difficult space to be in. One thing is to beware of prejudging other people. I think sometimes it's easy to sort of assume things about other people without even checking it out. And it might be that somewhere, if we relate to the best in people, you know, even the most difficult person we're working with, actually, you know, they do want the best for the situation or whatever. And I think we've got to kind of try and give people the benefit of the doubt and try and relate to the best in people. And also support other people when they are making some sort of stand on their own values. And I think I've been in this situation. In fact, I've been one of the cowardly people myself, where, you know, someone in a situation is speaking out, and you're thinking, actually, I'm really glad that person's saying that, because it's true, and I'm really glad somebody said that. And that person sort of has been the one who stuck their head above the parapet. But there's also a slight warm breath, I think, that has to be the one. But, you know, we can support other people who are expressing positive values. We can make that a conscious practice. And, you know, sometimes other people go out on a limb, and, you know, we might be able to benefit a situation through supporting someone else, so slightly sort of less directly. We might feel we don't have much power in our work situation. Maybe we're a small cog in a big wheel, you know, and to some extent that may well be the case, but it's never completely the case. We are never completely powerless to have an effect, as I've been saying. We actually are having an effect anyway. But I think, again, this is something we can take on a bit more consciously, to have a beneficial effect on the collective situation. So whatever situation we're working in, maybe it's a company, for example. There may be ways that we can have some influence on the ethos of this particular work situation.
just by perhaps being ourselves and expressing our own values, and that kind of rubs off on people. I think we live in an age of kind of, you know, there's a very strong culture of individualism, and that, you know, maybe people do feel a bit disempowered around sort of big collective situations, but I think that's a very dangerous situation if we allow ourselves to feel disempowered. There's a film called The Corporation. I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's a very, very scary portrait of the sort of personality profile of a big corporation, which is basically, what's the word, psychopathic, yeah. And so, you know, you get this situation where you get basically decent people who probably don't want to, you know, cause havoc in the world, working within situations that are where somehow the responsibility for what that collective is doing has been somehow abnegated. People feel they're not really responsible themselves. They're just that sort of small cog. And, you know, this is how the worst things that happen on the planet, this is how they happen, is by, I mean, there's some little saying about it which I can't remember, but when ordinary people kind of turn a blind eye, you know, you get whatever, Nazi Germany or, you know, some hideous corporation or whatever. So, you know, we are all responsible for the collective situations that we are part of, whether that be who we bank with or, you know, there's all sorts of ramifications of that, aren't there? Perhaps aren't the province of this particular talk. Yeah, so don't wash our hands of collective responsibility. And that may be very hard, but we've got to stay with that if we are going to have a positive effect. So a little bit on the quickly. I don't know how I started a little bit late, but yeah, I'll carry on. A little bit on the traditional Buddhist teachings on right livelihood. So, you know, some situations are perhaps more consciously ethical, more consciously out to benefit the world. Many are sort of perhaps relatively neutral. You know, it's not a particularly great, it's not a particularly bad thing. You know, it's just a particular job that is one of those things that we do in the world. Traditional Buddhism does name some things that are definitely not right livelihood. So there's a list of things that we are advised to steer clear of if we possibly can. People don't always have a choice about these things, but if we can. So dealing in weapons, not a great form of livelihood. Dealing in human beings, so there's all sorts of stuff goes on, isn't there? People trafficking and sex trade, and it's all going on. Goes on in this country, goes on in Brighton, where I live. It's all happening, these things. And dealing in living beings, so this obviously is quite tricky. This comes into the whole thing about farming and how farm animals are treated. I'm not actually vegan, but I do, you know, I accept that's the, what's the word, logical conclusion of not dealing in living beings, not buying and selling living beings for profit, so, you know, cows and sheep and whatever. Poisons. So poisons, you know, depends how broad a definition you want to. That might include quite a lot of things. Dealing in poisons and dealing in intoxicants. So, you know, having a job down the offie or behind a bar
You know, if you think about it, you think about the sort of state people are going out, you know, the effects of that, well, probably isn't a great livelihood. I have worked in bars when I was younger, I must admit. Okay. So the Buddha, talking about livelihood, he talks about what's called the four appropriate happinesses. I quite like this because sometimes Buddhism is a bit sort of otherworldly and it's sometimes a bit hard to relate to kind of real life, ordinary life. Here we go. The four appropriate happinesses connected with the work that we do. And the first is the happiness of ownership. So the person experiences pleasure, he experiences happiness, thinking, I possess this wealth that has been obtained by my own diligent labour, acquired through the strength of my own arms and the sweat of my own brow, rightly acquired, rightly gained. This is the happiness of ownership. So, you know, we go out and earn an honest buck and there's something satisfying in that. The happiness of enjoyment. So he experiences pleasure. He experiences happiness, thinking, through this wealth that has been obtained by my own diligent labour, sweat of my own brow, and so on, I have derived benefit and performed good works. So, you know, I've done something useful with those resources. I'm happy with that. Third one is the happiness of freedom from debt. Experiencing pleasure, happiness, reflecting, I owe no debts, be they great or small, to anyone at all. So that's the happiness of non-dependency, we might say. And then lastly, the happiness of blamelessness. So something, we're getting more into that realm of something to aim for as a longer term project. Now, well, some of the others are probably a longer term project as well, but experiences pleasure and happiness, thinking, I am possessed of blameless bodily actions, blameless speech and blameless thoughts. So this is joy in a free heart. So this comes back to the effects that we're having and perhaps a growing confidence that overall we are having a good effect, you know, perhaps more good than bad. So this is something that brings great happiness, and the Buddha says, well, this is by far the greatest happiness. So all of those other things, they do bring us happiness, you know. It's nice to earn money, it's nice to have nice stuff, maybe share it with others, hopefully, or whatever. And to feel that we're, you know, that we're supporting ourselves in the world. But, you know, it's far more important to know that the effect that we're having is something that we can be happy with. So there's two things, Hri and Apatrapia, you might come across. Hri is the sense of sort of one's own conscience, you know, that we feel okay about what we're doing. And Apatrapia is the respect of other people who we respect, that other people would look at our lives and feel, yeah, you know, I recognize that, you know, what you're doing is a benefit. So those two things kind of go together. It's not just our own, it's not just how we feel about ourselves, but we also get reflected back by other people. Which brings me on to, this is one of the big things about a work situation. I don't know if any of you went to Satchitji's talk yesterday. Fantastic talk. If you didn't, check it out. I'm sure it'll turn up on Free Buddhist Audio or something. Talking about building Buddha Field and what's called team-based right livelihood. Now, this is, we're coming into the Triratna Buddhist order and a particular take on right livelihood, which is the value of people working together in teams and practicing together and creative livelihood situations which are supportive of Buddhist values. So that the idea being to create a work situation with other people where which is supportive of our own practice, meditation practice, going on retreat, or things that will benefit us as individuals, where we feel we're doing something of benefit in the world, maybe making, you know, using money that's being made for, you know, to fund projects that need funding and so on. There's a lot can be said about team-based right livelihood, and it's something I personally believe in very, very strongly. I think for me, work situations I've been in, working with other people, being reflected back by other people, I would say has been more a much stronger growing point probably than anything else in my life. And I imagine that is the case for a lot of us, that we would say it's through our work that we have developed who we are developing, you know, that we've brought out our skills, that we've learned to relate to other people, that we're in, you know, in an ongoing process of developing as a human being. And, you know, we spend a lot of our time working, most of us, so, you know, it's very, very important that if we do want to practice, we can find some way of really bringing that practice into our work. So working with other people is only useful if we're able to be open to feedback that we get. And we might get positive feedback, and we might get not so positive feedback. And so I'm not talking about kind of harsh, nasty stuff, which, you know, we might need to protect ourselves from sometimes. But, you know, we do get feedback. Satchit talked brilliantly about this yesterday from the objective situation and from other people. Things don't go the way we want them to. We realise that other people have different ideas, all sorts of things. And we need to find ways of being open to that feedback, which often means sitting with an uncomfortable feeling. Lots of things, I'm afraid, in Buddhist practice seem to come back to the ability to sit with an uncomfortable feeling. You know, somebody's telling me, you know, they didn't think it was that great, you know, the way I did that thing. And I can learn from that. There's the potential to learn from that if you know, if we have a bit of humility and a bit of openness. You know, quite often it's the really difficult times when things aren't going very well that we really can change and make a shift. So that's part of it, you know, and that's part of having an objective task that we need to do, you know. Sometimes we don't succeed very well, you know, and we need to kind of learn to really be open to that and sort of receive the teaching. But also, we can have a lot of fun working with other people. You know, if we, you know, get on with people, we can find a way of connecting with people. And we can develop friendships. And I feel within Buddhafield, I feel incredibly grateful for some of the friendships that have kind of come about through working alongside people, this kind of side-to-side thing, you know. Yeah, we might not have had individual heart-to-hearts over cups of tea or something, but, you know, something like trying to get this festival on or whatever. You know, you kind of learn what each other are made of quite quickly, you know. And yeah, it's not always as flattering as one might hope, but that's part of it. It's real, you know, and I think friendship comes out of that as well, or it can do. I know it's a common experience. People come to Buddhafield, they feel part of something, and it's really lovely, and they feel sort of love, and they feel loved and everything. But then they go away, and it's like, oh, it's evaporated. What was that? Was it real? And I think real friendship requires more effort, actually. It's something we can't just sort of get it from a situation. It's something we need to put energy into for ourselves. And yeah, I think that goes beyond just being in a sort of positive situation together. But I think, you know, working with people can go a long way to being seen, seeing and being seen. It's back to this thing about recognition. You know, valuing each other, each person in their niche. Everybody's different, you know, and we start to we start to value people who are different because they're different. You know, quite often it's easy to fall out with someone because they're different, because they've got a different idea. But I mean, we couldn't possibly do something like this if we were all the same. So, you know, the fact that one person wants to do the ecstatic dance and someone else wants to sort out the plumbing and, you know, this thing about niche, you know, like every species has its area where they flourish, and we're like that as well. And, you know, we come together, we create something. There was a thing last night in the ritual about the Vimalakirti Nidesha, which is a Mahayana sutra, where the term Buddha fields has sort of come from, as far as we know. And the Lichavi youths bring their individual parasols as offerings to the Buddha. So they each bring their own gift. And, you know, one imagines each parasol perhaps is different and has different sort of jewelled, you know, they're all very beautiful. And then the Buddha performs this kind of magical act just to kind of delight everyone, but also as a teaching. And the parasols are magically transformed into this vast canopy that covers the entire million world system galaxy. And it's, you know, sort of awe and wonder all around. But, you know, it's a bit like the festival, isn't it? Everyone brings their own gift, and through coming together and cooperating with other people, learning to cooperate, learning to create something together, something, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and how true that is. You know, we couldn't, none of us could do any of this on our own. So, yeah, I think that's probably a good place to stop. Thank you. Thank you very much, Akashiti, for a very relevant and good talk. We've got time for like taking one or two questions, but the other session is starting in half an hour, so we've got to make it quick.
Actually, I tell you what I'd like to do is, if you'd like to, I'd like to invite you to get into maybe threes or something and just have a little check-in with a couple of other people here about your own work situation. Just for a couple of minutes, or a few minutes, and maybe we'll have something to share from that. What time should we kind of... Yeah, okay. So, feel free to head off if you want to. If you'd like to take this opportunity to explore something a little bit, if there was anything that was particularly relevant in the talk, or just the theme of, you know, is the work I'm doing, to what extent does it feel like right livelihood, is there some way that I could bring that practice into my work more fully? Let's have about 6 or 7 minutes, and I'll find some sort of bell to ding, and then we'll just have a little, if anyone's got something to share, and we'll close. Is it off?